This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, we're back here with Mike Disney from Cardiff University in Wales. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the Jodcast.
Thank you.
Now, thank you very much, first of all, for taking part in our April Fool's edition of the Jodcast set in 1990. We thought we'd catch back up 20 years of Hubble history and find out what's happened since the launch of Hubble. In our conversation, we talked about the mirror, for a start, the perfect mirror that was built for Hubble. Now, at the point just before launch, we didn't know that there was any kind of problem with the mirror, and that was only discovered just afterwards. Can you just tell us a little bit about that first?
Well, I can tell you what happened to me. I was here in Cardiff, just about to go out, when a friend of mine rang up and said, the images look ridiculous in the telescope, and there's a lot of us here think it may be spherical aberration. And I can remember banging my head on the mirror because it seemed that nothing worse could possibly happen. And of course, that's what did happen. And then the next 2 years was a fascinating but ultimately futile attempt to try and find some way of unscrambling those images. And hundreds and hundreds of clever people from all walks of science all had strong opinions. Some said it could easily be done using a big enough computer. Others said that's nonsense. And in the end, the answer turned out to be basically it couldn't be done. And so, as you all know, we tried to fit spectacles basically to the telescope and succeeded in doing that. And 3 years later, it worked.
That was an amazing piece of engineering to diagnose the problem from the ground and then to build a solution and to send it up into space with astronauts who installed the new lenses on Hubble.
Yes, it was. I think the wisest decision taken about Hubble from beginning to end was that it should be repairable, updatable, and that's the great thing about the space shuttle. This is the one mission for which it's designed to evolve. And as we know now, it's been visited, I can never remember, it's 4 or 5 times, but each time we've updated its instrumentation. And it's a very much more powerful instrument now than it was when we launched it.
And we talked about some of the science that Hubble might do. Can you tell us about some of the areas that you've been interested in particularly over the last 20 years?
Well, I did mention quasars, and so I was lucky enough to lead one of the teams looking at quasars with a repaired telescope. And sure enough, when we looked, you could see that they were interacting galaxies, one of which at least had a massive black hole at its core. The second thing that others have done is to demonstrate that virtually all galaxies, all massive galaxies, have massive black holes in their cores. And that's exciting, very exciting, and we don't really understand that. We don't understand whether the black hole came first or the galaxy. But I think the most shocking thing in a way, or one of the shocking things is, when we were designing Hubble's cameras way back in the 70s and 80s, we were told by cosmologists we wouldn't be doing any cosmology because all the galaxies you could see, the very distant ones, would be too faint to be seen with a Hubble. So you can imagine the surprise and shock we had whenever we took a deep frame, whenever we take one now, it's all covered, plastered with lots of faint galaxies. And I have to say, the cosmologists have been completely shameless about it. They've never apologized. But one feels there's something weird going on there, at least I do. And, of course, Hubble played a big role in discovering that the universe is accelerating, or dark energy, or whatever you like to call it. That surely is a shock. And that's the kind of size of shock we'd all hope for and predict it. And I don't think anybody has any idea what's going on. So looking back on it now, although I didn't do the things particularly I wanted to do, and that probably applies to everybody, we've done different things. And Hubble's been immensely productive in every aspect. And it's interesting now that most of the papers that are written with the Hubble are actually used the archive, which means there's far more exciting data sitting on computers, which anybody can play with, than you can get from carrying out your own observing program with Hubble. So it's a real mine of exciting nuggets that are still there to be found.
And we briefly mentioned extrasolar planets. Of course, in 1990, we didn't know of any. The first one was 1992, which was around a pulsar, and then 1995 was the first around a sun-like star. Okay. But Hubble has recently identified, going back in the archives, as you mentioned, some extrasolar planets as well, hasn't it?
Yes, it hasn't been the main driver in the extrasolar planet game. That's been done by ground-based telescopes using radial velocity meters. But yes, it's certainly been used to characterize some of the exoplanets that have been found. And maybe that activity will increase with a new camera on board.
Can you just tell us about the new camera?
Cameras wear out in space. Cosmic rays do them no good. So it was recognized about 10 years ago that we ought to put a new camera in for about 2005. And at the same time, detectors are improving enormously. We can build far better detectors now than we could back when Hubble was launched. So a team was set up, an American-European team was set up to build what was called Wide Field Camera 3, and I've been lucky enough to be involved in that. And we just finally, with all the delays to shuttle and everything else, we just launched it last year. And I'm pleased to say it's an absolutely staggering instrument. It's got 90% quantum efficiency across a huge range, all the way from the ultraviolet to the infrared, etc., etc., etc. And the net result is that the whole telescope is basically a new telescope. It's a new space telescope. And within the first few days, we were finding galaxies at redshifts of 7 or 8, you know.
So that's very far back in the universe.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if somebody told me you could do that when we started out, I'd have just laughed. I thought that would have been a complete fairy story.
And is there anything in particular that's your favourite thing that you've been involved with in Hubble?
Well, I think the quasar program was very interesting because it was sort of direct. You could see people of my generation had been puzzling over quasars for 30 years. They were the thing, you know. To see that they were indeed, as some people had speculated, in the middle of galaxies, and these galaxies were quarrelling with each other and possibly swallowing one another. Just to see it, you know, there it was. That was exciting to me.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us and sparing some time to tell us about the Hubble Space Telescope. Mike Disney, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.